For the book business, this summer was a season of discontent. Amazon, the giant online retailer, and Hachette Book Group, publishers of the Little Brown imprint, among others, had locked horns. At stake were the terms for doing business moving forward. Hachette executives wanted the power to set prices for their books, and Amazon recoiled at being deprived of its trademark deep discounts. While the negotiations went on behind closed corporate doors, authors and readers saw a new, and many thought, darker side of Amazon. Hachette books became listed at full price or even as unavailable. And when readers did order such books, they learned delivery would take weeks. Even Amazon's recommendation engine got involved, frequently suggesting alternatives to Hachette titles. Authors, and not only Hachette authors, responded with condemnation of Amazon as a monopolist and a bully. In the shadow of the Ukrainian civil war then raging, Jeff Bezos was even likened to Vladimir Putin. Frustrated readers soon began to reconsider their relationship with Amazon, and by extension, with the digital marketplace. Even Wall Street wavered in its longstanding support of Amazon's stock. The share price has fallen nearly 20% off its 52-week high. Now, just 10 days ago, the two sides announced a deal that will allow Hachette to set its own prices, but which Amazon says also encourages the publisher to deliver lower prices. In other words, both publisher and retailer have declared victory and gone home. Yet the book community, publishers, authors, and readers, may not be prepared to let them go. At the National Book Awards on Wednesday evening last week, writer Ursula Le Guin chastised publishers who put profit before art, even as she called Amazon a profiteer. And she also called on her colleagues in writing to rise up against the prevailing order. She said, "Books aren't just commodities. The profit motive is often in conflict with the aims of art. We live in capitalism. Its power seems inescapable. But then so did the divine right of kings. Any human power can be resisted and changed by human beings. Resistance and change often begin in art," she said, "very often in our art, the art of words." Our panel today will consider that challenge to take up resistance in the digital marketplace. And we will ask, if the future of writing, publishing, and reading lies in a digital world, who gets to decide what that world looks like? And joining me for that discussion, I want to introduce from the very far end, Andrew Albanese, senior writer of Publishers Weekly. Andrew, welcome. Andrew is the author of the Kindle e-book single, Battle of 999, How Apple, Amazon, and the Big Six Publishers Changed the e-book Business Overnight. Andrew Albanese has covered the publishing and information technology fields since 1999 and is a former editor with Oxford University Press and Reagan Books. To his right is Franklin Foer. Frank, welcome. Franklin Foer is editor of The New Republic, which is celebrating its centennial in 2014. He is editor of Insurrections of the Mind, 100 Years of Politics and Culture, an anthology of essays culled from the TNR archives. Founded by Herbert Crowley and Walter Lippmann in 1914, The New Republic gave voice to the growing progressive movement and became a leading left-wing voice in American politics and culture. Frank Foer's international bestseller, How Soccer Explains the World, An Unlikely Theory of Globalization, has been translated into 27 languages. And then to his right is Astra Taylor. Astra, welcome. Astra is a writer and documentary filmmaker, author of The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age, which was a New York Times Book Review editor's choice. Her films include Zizek, a feature documentary about the world's most outrageous philosopher, broadcast on the Sundance Channel, and Examined Life, a series of excursions with contemporary thinkers. And finally, to my left here, Oren Tyker. Oren, welcome. Oren became CEO of the American Booksellers Association in 2009. Founded in 1900, the ABA at bookweb.org is a not-for-profit trade organization for independently owned bookstores. At the ABA for nearly 25 years, Oren's worn many hats. He was Associate Executive Director, Director of Government Affairs, and Chief Operating Officer. And in 2013, PW named Tyker and the ABA board the PW Person of the Year for their role in leading the resurgence of independent book selling. So indeed, a warm welcome to all the panel. And Andrew Albanese, I'd like to start with you because I sketched very briefly the impasse that came to everyone's attention this summer. I wonder if you could fill in the details a little bit more. How did we get there, and what does it mean, or what did it mean at that time to the book business?
How did we get here? Well, I'm assuming most of you have some idea. I've been following the Amazon-Hachette dispute. And let me just ask a quick question of you first. Over the course of this discussion and debate, how many of you would say you sided with Hachette? Show of hands. And how many of you would say that you were siding with Amazon? Okay. And most of you, I assume, are thinking it's a little too complicated to pick one side or the other. And I'm not asking this so I can pander my argument to you. But
right. But it's interesting to me, if I could say, Andrew, that there were more show of hands for the publisher's side of things than for Amazon.
Oh, you're good if you can count that quickly. Good, good.
It seemed that way to me, absolutely.
Well, but, you know, here was my... As somebody who covered this for Publishers Weekly, who's been covering the industry for a long time, I was a little disappointed in the way this all unfolded over the summer, because it was pitched to us sort of as this battle for the future of the book. And in reality, what it was a negotiation between two parties. And we knew how that negotiation was going to end. It was going to end with a deal. And as public as the debate has been, it was going to end with a private deal that's confidential, that we don't know exactly what's in that contract. And that was a little frustrating to me, because I believe that we need to have a good conversation about the future of digital reading. We have to talk about, you know, digital rights management and data and libraries and all of these things. But the confidential end to this public book debate made me think that, you know, we're a long way from getting that conversation. So I was a little disappointed that we didn't have a broader conversation about the future of digital reading when we had the chance. And I hope we still can have that conversation. But now that Amazon and Hachette have ended their negotiation with a deal and everyone's supposedly just thrilled with it, I wonder where we go from here.
Right. Well, Andrew, I was asking how we got here because, you know, for a number of years, the book business has been, you know, selling books via Amazon. They've had a relationship going back to really the very beginning of e-retailing. Why now? Why did this come to an impasse this year? It's about e-books, really, I think.
It is about e-books, and I will put it this way. We often refer to Amazon as a retailer, but in reality, Amazon, when it comes to e-books, is a platform. They invested heavily in inventing the Kindle, and they really did create the commercial e-book market that we now enjoy today. And that's been a net plus, I think, for people, that we now have this commercial e-book market. How we manage that commercial e-book market is difficult, and we're having a little bit of a rough start at the beginning here, no question. So I think what the real problem was that, well, if we're going to talk about Amazon in terms of monopoly, then we also have to talk about the big five publishers in terms of being a cartel. They control 90% of the bestseller list. One company controls 50% of the bestseller list. So I think it's appropriate to ask the question, where would the commercial ebook market be if it was just left to those five publishers? Well, it probably wouldn't be where it is now. So I think what we're seeing is sort of the beginning stages of a longer battle over who's going to or how we're going to access digital books.
Right. But if it was a conversation, a negotiation, I should say, between two private parties in private, why should we care? You know, when they announced the deal just 10 days ago, both sides said they were happy. Michael Peach, who is the CEO of the Hachette Book Groups, said he was happy. He also told the New York Times he was happy about moving out of his private office and into a 6x7 cube as well. So we wonder. But if they're happy, if those two parties are happy, why shouldn't the people in this room and watching now be happy as well?
Well, I can tell you why I'm not happy about this. And, you know, price is a big part of this. We're all talking about what the price of books are going to be, how artists are going to be and authors are going to be compensated for their work, and that's a big part of it. But if we accept that the future of reading is digital, and I do, because I have a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old, and they tool around on my iPad like they were born with it, and they also read a lot of other books, too. They love books, too. But if we accept that the future of reading is digital, then we're accepting a world where platforms are closed, where you have to buy one, you know, certain device to access books and you lose them if they go away. We're talking about our data being mined and privacy. We're having all of these issues are being sorted out behind closed doors by these companies, and the public doesn't have a seat at the table. And we really need to have a seat at the table there. So, I mean, I'm displeased just because there should be some sort of transparency. You're right. Books are different. Ursula Le Guin is right. Books are different. So I think we need to hold them to a different standard, and we need to be in the room when the digital future is being, you know, hashed out.
Frank Foer, you want to see Amazon held to account for behaving as a monopoly. Now, that's going to take some work because of the way antitrust law works. I wonder if you can give your perspective on that. And in your article for the New Republic last month, you talked about the size of Amazon's dominance. And I think the numbers are that they control 41% of book sales and 67% of e-book sales. Not overwhelming, but certainly very powerful.
I mean, I'm sorry to say that is overwhelming. In the history of American political economy, and if we step back decades when antitrust was vigorously enforced in this country, those are numbers that would have spurred the government to have intervened to break up the company or to impose other sorts of remedies. And let me just start. You described the New Republic as being left-wing, which is a description that many who are left-wing would dispute. And I say that because I believe in capitalism, and I come from a position on the center-left that doesn't particularly favor the government intervening in the market with a very heavy footprint. But on this issue, I come down very strongly on the side against Amazon. And that's because when I come to this festival and I look at what literary culture means to people, and I look at the vibrancy that is here, and I see 5 years down the line that this could be imperiled. The book is under threat right now, and we shouldn't mince words in talking about it. And the reason is simple.
Well, the book is not under threat, but the book business, perhaps.
No. But when the book business is under threat, the book is under threat. And I can start by explaining this as where I come from as an author. When I sit down to write a book, I need to have somebody sponsoring my project because I'm not independently wealthy. If I want to go take a year or 2 years or 3 years out of my life, which is what is required to produce a quality work of fiction or nonfiction, in some cases, some of us are superhuman and can race faster than that. But I'm not a superhuman writer. I need to take my time in order to read, to think, to report, in order to come up with the book. I can't do that unless somebody helps subsidize that effort. And the relationship that I have with my publisher is that my publisher, I submit an idea to a publisher, and the publisher either likes the idea or doesn't like the idea. And fortunately, right now, there are at least five different corporations I can sell my work to in a whole variety of smaller publishers and university presses. If one of those people likes my idea, they're willing to give me an advance on sales in the future. And it's an incredible act of faith that they take in becoming a creditor in my project, just as it's an incredible act of faith when a bank gives you money to buy a new house. So I enter into a relationship with a publisher that enables me to go and write that project. What's happening now, because of Amazon's dominance of this business, Amazon is able to exert ever greater power over the publishers. And so Amazon is under pressure from its stockholders to produce ever greater returns to them. And so what the stockholders ask of Amazon is, show us more revenue.
Right.
And so the way that they do that is they go to the publishers and they say, show us more revenue. And so they cut these deals with the publishers that squeeze the publishers. And when the publishers get squeezed, they end up squeezing the authors. And it makes it harder and harder for people to take the types of financial risks that are necessary to produce the types of books that you enjoy at a festival like this.
Right. Well, you know, someone described the way Amazon goes about that price cutting that you described as rather like what a chef does to a chicken, right? It just sort of cuts away and cuts away and cuts away till every piece of meat is stripped off the bone. And that's really the approach, at least in this person's view, that Amazon has taken.
So let me concede that Amazon is a fantastic company in so many ways, that it's a miracle that you can get any book delivered to your phone whenever you want it. It's a miracle that they're able to get books to you at your home in a day or two when you push a button. That's incredible. But they, you know, that's created circumstances, though, where it's almost impossible for anybody to compete against them. They're leveraging all these investments that they've made in becoming an everything store and producing technology and establishing contracts with the Postal Service and with UPS that make it almost impossible for anybody to compete with them. And so if nobody can compete with them and their share of the book market is going to grow every year, we have to either accept that fact and say that books are going to be dominated by one company and appreciate the dangers that imposes to our literary culture, into our very democracy, or we do something about it.
Right. Well, Amazon's not here, as far as I know. But if they were, they might say that the book business is broken and that book publishers are, I think you used the phrase in your book, you were quoting somebody else, a bunch of antediluvian losers. Is Amazon right? I mean, do they have a point that perhaps the way that world worked in the past was great at that moment, but we are in a digital marketplace and things have changed?
Yeah, there's a lot that I don't like about the publishers. I don't like that there are five big companies that dominated. I don't like it that they've been slow to adapt to the digital marketplace. And I'm sure as corporations, they could behave in a much more profit-seeking sort of way. But what I do like about the publishers is that they take a lot of intellectual risks, that they have very good taste, that they're able to subsidize writers in doing projects that take long times to do, and that they then in turn help promote works of fiction and nonfiction to
the
public.
And poetry, by the way, we should point out. Right.
And the more that we depend on one company, and the more that publishing constricts. And what happens is that when you have one big company dominating the market, all the other publishers band together to try to seek safety. So Penguin merges with Random House, and suddenly we go from having six publishers to five publishers. Hachette tries to merge with Perseus and tries to become bigger. And as these companies become bigger and fewer, I, as a writer, have fewer places that I can sell my project. And so, it's kind of a miracle that I can get one of these guys to buy one of my books. But if I'm selling to only one or only two of them, then I'm dependent on the whims of those publishers for accepting my idea.
Right. And I think that brings us right to the heart of Astrid Taylor's argument in her book, People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age. And Astrid, that must sound very familiar to you. And I think one of the points that you made in the book, which is I think, critical to this discussion right now, that culture is the stage where anxieties about the marketplace sort of have a light shone on them, that we see them in full view. And one of the anxieties about this marketplace that you feel we ought to have is that rather than giving us a leveled playing field, the kind of promise of the web at the very early days, we see a playing field that's very much tilted in favor of enormous players, the way that Frank was describing.
Yeah, my book takes a sort of broad look at the digital media landscape, and as someone who has worked as an independent filmmaker and also toured for the last year and a half with an independent rock band and looks at some of the sort of mythology that the internet would necessarily be a kind of leveler of the cultural playing field and that it would kind of act as a sort of Robin Hood stealing from the audience rich and giving to the audience poor. So my book, my title, The People's Platform, is sort of aspirational. It's in the one sense, well, wouldn't it be great if we actually had a people's platform, a different space, not just commercial publishers or commercial broadcasters? But it's also a slightly sarcastic almost, because the point is that almost all of these spaces that we visit and spend our time on online are commercial spaces. I mean, with the exception of Wikipedia, which is one of the only non-commercial websites that we visit en masse. So what I look at is the way that the problems of the old media landscape, and I'm someone who became an independent journalist and an independent filmmaker because I was critical of what the mainstream was offering and what was out there, but how problems of consolidation, centralization, and commercialism have carried over. And so instead of this thing that was predicted by sort of all of the technology pundits that the internet would disintermediate the old guard and allow for this new era of like competition and flourishing, what we're seeing is consolidation. Exactly what you're describing is that in the face of these new digital giants like Amazon, book publishers are merging. there was one actual, there's a mistake in the hardcover edition of my book. When I started writing the project, there were five big record labels, and actually there are three now, so I just had to correct that for the paperback. And they control an overwhelming amount of the music market. Something like 20 of the 23 top hip-hop singles of the last year were all from Universal Music Group. So this consolidation is perpetuated in the digital space because there's a tendency to monopoly online that wasn't really acknowledged by the people who were sort of describing the wonderful transformations that were supposed to be upon us.
Right, and your book goes into some of the ironies about this initial promise of the web and the reality that we see in 2014, and you focus in one place on the word open, which has a wonderful communal sound to it, but is also part of the open market, the free market. So it's both communal and capitalistic, which seems kind of an oxymoron.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing about thinking about Amazon as a platform. Is it open? Yes, in the sense that people can self-publish through it, but it's also a sort of walled garden. It's very closed. Once you're locked into its Kindle platform, then you cannot freely take the ebooks you've got there. I mean, I think in addition to these three things: consolidation, centralization, commercialism, there's also the return of a vertical integration, which is a kind of, you know, we've entered this kind of retrograde future. So you have something like Amazon that's the book, the bookshelf, the bookseller. It's also a web hosting company, so the CIA uses it for web hosting, as do lots of other companies like Netflix and Pinterest. It also is involved in content creation, and I think this is worrying for those of us who are independent creators. It's that Amazon is also a publisher. It's also getting involved in film production. You see this with Netflix. So as a documentarian, we rely on Netflix as our major film distribution channel. But now they are making original content, not just series, but also documentaries. And so they have this front page that is global, and they promote their films that they've generated. And you, as a smaller filmmaker on there, just have to hope that their personalization algorithm surfaces your project, because you're not getting that front page placement. So I think, yeah, there's a kind of paradox that it feels as though we're all in charge of our media destinies, and we can watch whatever we want, we can comment on whatever we want online, and yet there are some counter forces that haven't been totally acknowledged. And so, you know, in the end, ultimately, what I'm wondering why public options aren't on the table. I mean, I respect your suspicion of government intervention in the marketplace, but I'm a little bit with Ursula Le Guin on this. I'd like to see a discussion about what public spaces on the web might look like and non-commercial alternatives, because I think there's been too much emphasis on what the web does for us as consumers and not enough on what it does for us as citizens. And I think we,
Well, and I think you make the point. I think you make the point very strongly in the book that the situation as it prevails today isn't somehow a natural situation, that it has to be that way. It can be different, and that's why I picked that line from Ursula Le Guin's remarks. What she was saying was that things can change because human beings can change them.
Yes.
And Oren Tyker from the ABA, and I want to ask you about how booksellers felt watching all of this transpire this summer. They've had a bone to pick with Amazon for some time. How did it feel to watch somebody else battling with them?
Well, you know, Chris, the title of your session about monsters living in laptops is pretty apropos, and it's important to disabuse you of the notion that the monsters in this laptop are the kind of Muppet cuddly kind of folks. These are big, massive companies. I think Andrew referred to the concern about a business in which the large publishers are dominating the business. And a lot of us in the book business obviously had some concern about that recent consolidation between Penguin and Random House. But think about this. The combined global empire of those combined companies do 5% of the sales that Amazon does. And if you take the big five publishers and put them all together, we're barely in double digits in compared to what Amazon sales are. So this is a real example of size really matters. And this company, Amazon, is massive. And it influences everything. about the book business. So as we watched what happened this summer, you know, what we were, you know, frankly, reminded about was with something that, you know, that Jeff Bezos said and others from Amazon have said. I'm not usually fond of quoting Mr. Bezos, but he did say that they started out 12, 15 years ago selling books because you, book buyers, you're great consumers. You buy a lot of other stuff. And what the book business has become the lost leader for Amazon to be able to sell flat screen televisions and shoes and diapers and every other commodity. Now that's perfectly, that's their business model. It's perfectly legal and there's nothing illegal about that. But those of us in the book business need to understand that our business, and ultimately, as Frank points out, the interests of consumers are being interfered with because there is a company that is using us as collateral damage to do something else.
From the bookseller's perspective, then, what is the nature of that interference? What exactly is Amazon doing that you would have them not do?
Well, I think the first thing that they're doing is attempting to eliminate any other person in the middle of that transaction. Frank described the role that that publishers play. The role that the publishing community plays is indispensable in this process. They're prepared to dispense with that. They want to drive prices down. There isn't a consumer I know who doesn't want to pay lower prices. But I would submit and suggest that there is no example over time in American history where that kind of concentration of power ultimately leads to the benefit of consumers. So I think size is important, and I think it really is critical to create a diverse culture in which a range of content is going to be available to Americans, let alone to folks around the world. We need a diverse culture. We need a diverse publishing community. Having all that power in one hand is not good.
Well, would you like to see the government look into this? We already have an example, and Andrew Albanese alluded to it, of a few years ago when there was the so-called ebook price-fixing case with Apple and the major publishers. We have the government now in the publisher's business. Would you like to see them get even deeper into publishing?
I thought that the Department of Justice case against publishers was the most one-sided example of the government looking at one half of the equation. I'm not here to suggest that Amazon's engaged in illegal practice. I don't know if they are or they're not. But they spent a lot of money investigating publishers. It seems to me, given the relative size of the publishing community and Amazon size, that having the government take a look at their practices would make some sense.
And Frank Foer, I think you would agree with that. You feel that at least looking at this would be a worthwhile exercise.
For sure. I mean, to me, this is the ball game. I mean, this is books are central to the production of ideas, and the production of ideas is central to having an educated citizenry and a robust democracy. And if we view that one company is on the brink of owning that industry and on the basis of tactics that are bullying and anti-competitive, then yeah, I want my government looking into that.
Well, and you know, you were quibbling about left, center, and so forth and so on. But regardless of one's position on that spectrum, should this be a political issue?
It is a political issue. It's not. I mean, especially since it's pretty clear that, look, there's a Democratic administration in power, and they have no interest in really investigating Amazon. And so, what's the alternative? The only alternative is that readers start to care about what's going to happen to the future of the books that they read. And so if readers go passively into this future and they don't start to ask questions about the future of this industry, then the future of the industry is inevitable. And so I don't actually think, as consumers, I think it's not really incumbent upon consumers to make the choices that government should be making for them. I'm sure that everybody, that the most anti-Amazon people in this room have used Amazon. I mean, it's just because Amazon's a damn good website, and it provides service cheap and efficiently. And you know, we've all needed diapers in the next 24 hours. Or, the problem is one that only government can effectively address.
Well, and if it is a political issue, political issues need leadership. Somebody has to take up the charge and turn it into a cause and get people to follow them on that. Where should the leadership come from? Should it be coming from, I mean, I think you've sort of hinted at that readers, it's not their responsibility. The leadership for this should come from where?
I mean, I do think it's readers' responsibility. Not necessarily consumers' responsibility to make to make virtuous choices at every turn, although I hope that they all shop at Mitchell Kaplan's bookshop and at Politics and Prose and Washington, D.C., and all the other great independent bookstores that we have in this country, because I view those things as kind of central to our sense of community and the literary culture that we have. But I think that readers should be asking questions of their politicians, and I think that it's politicians and... You know, there are a number of politicians who profess to care about antitrust and care about the consumers, and I think it's up to us as citizens and reader citizens to try to enlist those politicians to take up the cause.
Yeah. Right, and
Chris,
okay,
Chris, this isn't an esoteric argument. It is about whether or not books continue to get published in the United States. And the fact is that anybody who reads and likes to read has a stake in this debate. Now, you can be, as a reader, perhaps be passive about it, but I would suggest to you that every one of us who cares about the literary culture in this country, who cares about culture in this country, has a real stake in this conversation.
Right, and Astrid Taylor, I think you make the point that art, cultural work, is different from other types of work, and so to that question of whether books are different, you would say yes, they are.
Yes, I would say that there are reasons to put special protections on cultural market and to think about other options for funding them, like state subsidy. But one thing I would say is that I'm not sure, you know, labor is that different in either case. And there's a big anti-Amazon labor argument to be made, not just the people in the warehouses. There's an excellent article by Jess Bruder in Harper's recently about how a lot of retirees are actually recruited by Amazon to work for, you know, $11 an hour because they don't have other options for livelihood. So I want there actually to be labor solidarity between artists and workers. I do think a little bit too much, sometimes it feels as though the conversation is that Amazon came and changed everything, when the publishers are actually continuing behavior they've been engaging in for a long time. I mean, consolidation, the emphasis on blockbuster titles, these are problems that Andre Schifrin wrote about. And, you know, it's publishers continuing a longstanding trend, and we see the same thing in journalism, where there was a lot of consolidation in the industry, and when the internet came along and transformed the advertising market, they kind of started to do more of what they were already doing, which is cutting expensive foreign bureaus and beat reporting. So, I mean, there's a way in which pressures that have always been there and tendencies that have been there for a while are intensified by the digital transformation. And I think the response to that needs to be to support alternatives, to support independent publishers and support people who are doing a different kind of business.
Right. Andrew Albanese, I'd like to pick up that point because it's your view, I think, that publishers are, in a way, complicit in their own predicament, because for so long, when it came to innovation, when it came to finding their footing in the digital marketplace, they outsourced that. They left that all to Amazon.
I think that's true in a large case. I agree with everyone on the panel here. I think I just disagree a little bit about, you know, using antitrust as the weapon of choice here. I do think government has a role here. But I think that the questions are more cultural, more constitutional in nature even, than regulatory. And so I'm afraid that the antitrust process is not the right weapon of choice to have here. And you're right. Publishers, I would say, in our industry, we have a very bad case of Stockholm syndrome. Because, you know,
you have to tell people what that is.
Well, you know, you sort of begin to identify with your captor, because, you know, independent bookstores were, as Oren can tell you, were having troubles back when Barnes & Noble was encroaching. And then we're defending Barnes & Noble against Amazon. You know, we forget that the question that we really are addressing here is, how do we pay authors and writers? How do we guarantee a robust reading future? And these are questions that go well beyond the scope of antitrust. So, I mean, I would like to see us literally take these up in a much broader government, even if it's not the government, but a much broader cultural way than bringing the lawyers in the room. Because the one thing we do know is that once you bring the lawyers in the room, the public conversation stops.
Well, we're having that conversation right now. And Oren Tiger, I want to ask you about the business and how it is different. And certainly you want to stress that something that's different is there's a perception that independent bookstores are dying like, you know, leaves on the trees in the fall. But in fact, there's been a resurgence recently. And I want to give you an opportunity to tell that good message about sort of surviving in a digital marketplace with real product in bricks and mortar stores.
Yeah, the extraordinarily good news about our businesses, despite the challenges we face, we're actually doing well. I appreciated Frank's plug for Books and Books and for Politics and Prose, but there are a network, literally, of thousands of vibrant independent bookstores who are providing an extraordinarily indispensable function in their communities everywhere across the United States. And the good news is those stores are doing better today than they were a decade ago. Now, look, you know, owning and operating a small independent retail business of any kind is a challenge. We've got massive competition, and Amazon does do what they do well. What is clear is that there are millions, if not tens of millions, of American consumers who value going to a local place, interacting with the people who operate that place, in a way that has absolutely revolutionized our business. Some of you, I trust, are familiar that a week from yesterday, the 29th of November, is Small Business Saturday, an idea that American Express kind of cooked up a few years ago. Do you know that last year, across the network of independent businesses, not just bookstores, something like $5.7 billion was spent in independent businesses that day? So American consumers are voting with their feet and reacting to the value of why it is they want to support locally owned businesses. Bookstores have been in the forefront of that movement. So we are, in fact, hanging on. Consumers are responding, not without having to be smart entrepreneurs and reinventing our businesses and be able to adapt, including ways to take advantage of technology, including ways to sell a product online, to be able to communicate with our customers through social media. We've got to do all of those things in order to compete today, and the good news is that lots of stores are figuring that out.
Yeah, well, Astra Taylor, also hanging on, but barely, are writers and artists and musicians, and to take this subject just from a focus on Amazon to the broader picture, which you discuss in your book, which is the way that the web has created, I think you used the phrase, a peasant's kingdom, that the compensation which, you know, provided artists and musicians and writers in the pre-digital world has gone away in favor of, as an excuse was openness, a kind of contributory, collective publishing and media environment. Talk about how that feels as an artist, as a writer, as a filmmaker, and again, to your point about the way that we could change the nature of the web, how you could improve that situation for creators.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to deny all of the amazing new opportunities as someone who wants to communicate ideas and get them out there. I think the architecture of the internet, the fact that it is a many-to-many communications channel, is really remarkable, and we all know that. But I think there are some... We need to start looking ahead and look at the sort of forces that are shaping it and start actively trying to protect the good things about this new communications platform. So, you know, I think all independent creators, all citizens should be really concerned about the net neutrality debate, you know, which is sort of fundamental to the sort of infrastructure of the internet. It's about all of us being able to access the internet, which is sort of foundational. The thing is that instead of sort of creating this opportunity for everyone to contribute equally, this idea of the long tail where independent creators like myself would be able to find our audience, I think what we're really seeing is the missing middle. The fact that there is a sort of increasing divide between regular people being able to participate and communicate online and then sort of blockbuster global phenomenon. So we see this in the publishing industry with the emphasis on, you know, blockbuster books and, you know, celebrity memoirs and all of this. And it's a problem that's exacerbated in the digital space. And so what I'd like to see is, yeah, ways for us to bolster that missing middle. And I think part of it is protecting our institutions, our independent bookstores, because actually they really enable people to discover a far wider range of titles. Even though Amazon might have seemingly everything in its database, actually it's been shown that brick-and-mortar bookstores produce a far more heterogeneous purchasing pattern for consumers. So I think, you know, protecting our institutions. Also, articulating the fact that something that, you know, Amazon is very critical of publishing, for example, because of its inefficiency. The fact that some books don't pay their own way. So the big books go and the profits from those end up paying for a bunch of, you know, small or mid-sized titles that don't make money. And I think saying, no, actually, that's actually a good model. That's not something to be critical of. That's the fact, you know, a cookbook that sells 2 million copies can fund some poetry or some literary nonfiction or some politics or something. That's actually a value we want to, that's a model we want to keep. That's not something we want to get rid of in favor of, you know, everything paying its own way. So I think there's some, you know, articulating our values and what we want.
Right. And Frank, for, you know, investigative journalism, cultural criticism, those things have always had a hard time paying their own way, but it's become even more difficult.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I as a consumer of literary biography, I always underline the places where you see what somebody got paid in 1930 for a New Yorker article or for a contribution to the New Republic, and then I go into those calculators that can take that can calculate what $1930 dollars are into present value, and I'm always amazed that it's basically people got paid a lot more in 1930, even if the sums were very small. And then you couple that with
the Great Depression.
And then you couple with the fact that writers tend to live in metropolitan areas which have been most affected by economic inequality, where real estate prices skyrocket and the cost of living is extremely high. So we've gotten kind of hit by this double whammy of the way that cities have changed and the way that our industries have changed. And I mean, I do find myself kind of relying, as an editor, increasingly relying on, I've never gotten Knight Foundation money, although I wouldn't mind it, relying on nonprofits to subsidize writers, going to take trips to foreign places, to just the expensive type of journalism that we need to do. But I'm extremely concerned by the fact that that writers are turning into kind of serfs, and that it's just and that in 1930 you could live in kind of what was called Paul Goodman called decent poverty in a city. And if you wanted to make the noble choice to become a novelist to write a book that was experimental, that might not sell that much, you could still live a life in a big city where you could send your kid to a decent public school and you could live in a fine apartment. And that's just not possible anymore. It's not possible to live in decent poverty as a writer anymore. And that has a lot to do with changing mores, but it makes me sad. And I think that it all goes back to this fundamental point that if you look at our culture right now, go look at the New York Times bestseller list this morning. There are like two real books on that bestseller list, I'm sorry to say. And we're going to wake up 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and say, what the hell just happened? It's like it's like food. We consumed processed food for so many years, and we thought it maybe tasted pretty good and was convenient. And then we woke up and we said we're fat and dying of heart disease. And it's going to happen with culture. It's happening right now with culture. And we
I would say that's fair, but then, you know, we not only woke up and found ourselves not as well off as we thought we were, but we then chose to go to farmers markets and make choices that, regardless of what the price was.
That's an elite thing.
Well, no, but I mean, is it, though? Because what I was going to suggest what I was going to suggest was that you know, consumers made choices and they knew where value lay, and we've transformed the marketplace. There's greater choice than there was 20 years ago, even in a typical supermarket. So that happened because consumers drove it. So I wonder whether you think consumers and authors and publishers can drive that kind of change in the publishing marketplace.
Yeah, maybe to some degree, but I also look back at the history of publishing and the history of journalism, and the elites who ran those businesses viewed themselves as having certain responsibilities to the culture that they were making money off of, and that doesn't exist anymore. And you looked at Time magazine covers in the 1950s, and all the sociologists and philosophers and composers who were on the covers there. That was a culture governed. I mean, look, there were lots of problems with that elite, lots of problems with that elite. But there was still some responsibility that the people who ran publishing and ran journalism felt. And I still think that publishing has a sense of that type of responsibility. Publishing, for all its problems, publishes an extraordinary amount of literary fiction that may or may not provide massive profit margins. It still publishes an extraordinary amount of investigative journalism that may or may not produce profit margins. And so, as Astra says, we will forgive them for publishing whatever Kardashian book or whatever other dreck that they want to publish if it helps subsidize the good stuff.
Right. Well, Andrew Albanese, you talk to publishers every day. It's part of your job. And I wonder whether you have any sense that they feel that same responsibility that Frank was just talking about, or have they turned to simply the profit motive the way that Ursula Le Guin was condemning them for?
Well, I think it's true that publishers certainly do publish a lot of good. And I think that the model of, you know, using the Kardashian books to fund, it's a model they need to defend more and need to defend better, in a better way, I mean. But at the same time, I think with technology, we are on the cusp of a golden age for independent literature. I mean, you can get a book to market more cheaply, but we need to discuss, broader solutions, I think, to how we fund artists, how we fund things that matter to us, our institutions, our bookstores, our libraries. It's a big conversation that we need to be having. You know, right now, being an author, it's a lot like the situation, I think, in the country right now. If you're in the 0.1%, you're doing fine. Everyone else, not so much. And if you're in the middle, you're screwed. So I think we need to address how we prop up the middle here.
Right. And Oren Tykert, so how do we do that? Is it business practice? Is it technology? It's both, probably?
Well, it is. And, it's important to point out, that there are countries in the world that do figure out how to support cultural institutions. In a lot of Western Europe, in fact, government policy allows for a far more competitive cultural business, and specifically in the book business. There are different kinds of agreements in other countries that absolutely stabilize the business and promote the culture. So I agree, Andrew, that it doesn't only have to be public policy that enforces antitrust laws. I think that's a piece of it, because I don't think we can have blinders on as to pretend that that doesn't exist. But I think there's lots of other very positive things that the government can do to create a level playing field with regard to the way businesses operate. In our business, we've been fighting for a decade the absurdity that Amazon is being subsidized in many states across the country by not having to collect sales tax because they've cut some deal with some state legislatures to say, well, we'll put your warehouse there, but we don't have to collect sales tax. Well, you level the playing field. If consumers are buying that product, why should government be subsidizing one group of businesses over another? So I think there are a lot of very constructive things that can be done shy of going to court and spending your life with a bunch of lawyers to help level the playing field with regard to the way the book business operates.
Right. Frank Foer, and then I want to conclude with Astra. But
well, I just wanted to make one point, which is that as somebody who lives in the world of journalism, I've watched how expectations, there's a set of expectations we have as consumers about what we pay for with journalism, which is that we expect it to be free. and which is just impossible when you get what you pay for. When you don't pay anything for the journalism that you read, you get clickbait and you get gossipy dreck that's pandering to mass audiences, and that's no good. And so as consumers, we have to fight our better selves. We have to fight our worst selves on that one and try to and pony up when it's called to pony up. And I think that when you look at books, that's what scares me about Amazon and where this is pushing. It's that the possibility that we devalue books and devalue books by the actual price that we put on their dust jacket. That to me reflects values that we have as a society. And I do think that ultimately, as consumers, this is something that we do have to fight that self-interested impulse in ourselves.
Right. Astrid Taylor, great place to end before we go to questions from the audience, which is about values. And I believe it's your point that a real valid cultural democracy is not simply about a fight for attention, a contest for eyeballs. It's something more important.
Yeah, and I think that's how we've been framing the sort of digital landscape. It's like everybody can throw their hat into the ring at very low barrier to entry and then, you know, made the most viral succeed. And I think, you know, cultural democracy has to support things that we don't necessarily like in that sense of popularity that aren't the clickbait. On the analogy of food, that's something I actually go to at the end of my book. And I think there is a lot of the power of the purse is real, but I think it's a social problem. We can't just sort of spend our way into a cultural utopia. And on the food issue, the real problem is the subsidies the agricultural businesses get. Mm. And it's just this, it's, you know, that's what's shaping the whole system. And the media landscape is similar. Internet companies get many invisible subsidies, from the tax issue you raised to the fact that so much of the actual technology was actually financed by the state, and the corporate sector reaps rewards. So I think we need to look at those subsidies that are going to the private sector and try to at least put some public interest conditions on them, if not taking back some of the proceeds, investing them in ways that enhance our culture.
All right. Well, I see we have a line for questions, and so we're going to turn to our audience to continue the discussion, which is what we wanted to do. And if you'd step up, and if you have a question for a particular member of the panel, let us know who it's for.
My name's Gail. I don't really have a question for any particular person. We've been talking a lot about Amazon, and I'm a very big supporter of the arts, of the authors, of dancers, of painters, etc. But when our local bookstores are taken away from us, I mean, I live down in the Aventura area. I have to drive 45 minutes to an hour away to go to a bookstore to even just browse to see what kind of a book I want. How can I go ahead and support the authors and the different publishers when I don't have that ability given to me? There's no place for me to go except for Amazon. I mean, Penguin and some of the other publishers that you guys were talking about that are merging together, and that I was always under the assumption that I could get any book that I wanted from whatever publisher if I went through Amazon, since I didn't have a bookstore to be able to go to. So how can I continue to support the local without having to go to the giant?
So the question is there a workaround?
Yeah, do you ever go to booksandbooks.com? Do you know that Books and Books can sell you exactly the same books that Amazon can? Look, our business isn't based on what we do online by any stretch of the imagination, but the fact is there can't be a bookstore in every community in the country. There are more of us today than there were a decade ago, but the fact is that, yes, there are communities that are underserved. We're trying to address that, but you can shop online at any bookstore, have access to exactly the same.
As long as you know their names. I mean, yes, most everybody here in Miami knows Books and Books. But let's face it, you know, if you're not in Miami and you're in a smaller area in Florida, or you're in Texas and some other place in the country that doesn't have a Books and Books, and they are out of borders, there's no more Barnes and Nobles around. There was a kid's bookstore that used to be in Aventura that I was in walking distance that I used to go to with my children. They're in college now. They are no longer. They haven't been there in 15 years. If you don't know of a Books and Books that's in your community that you can go online, I mean, if you don't know a publisher that has is, you know, of a favorite author that you know is being published by that publisher, you can, I mean, can you go to that publisher online and buy a book from the publisher directly?
Well, I think...
I'm ignorant in that regard. I'll admit that.
Well, I think what we could suggest is you go to bookweb.org, which is the ABA website, and look for a local publisher, or sorry, a local bookseller. I want to go to the next person in line for another question.
You started out the panel talking about how e-books have changed the landscape. I definitely agree that's true. How do you answer the argument that Amazon can actually be a wonderful thing for new and smaller authors who can now self-publish and get a much higher percentage of royalties than any of the publishers could ever give them?
Well, that's the Amazon argument, certainly, and it's taken up by a lot of independent publishers and independent authors. And Andrew Albanese, I think you recognize that point, that Amazon has done a lot of good for writing, for authors, and by extension, publishing.
I think that's absolutely true, and that is the Amazon argument. My problem with Amazon is that, you know, you can publish a book through Amazon, and you can use their self-publishing platforms, but... You know, if you're a library, it's difficult to buy those books. And once you buy them on the Kindle, you can't easily transfer them anywhere else. I mean, they're sort of a walled little garden there. But I would agree entirely that you can an author who has a book who wants to reach an audience can do so more easily now than ever before in history. And Amazon has been a part of that.
Next question, please.
Hi, my name is Jacques LaRoche. I just want to reiterate... Just a few things, some comments and a question. I want to reiterate what the first commenter said, or the question that she asked. Really, like, get to the point. The heart is that rational choice theory doesn't really work. Like, there was an analogy that was about food. And when you look at, like, poor Black and Latino communities, we don't have access to food in certain places, right? So that's another example of where this rational choice theory doesn't work. Like, if you don't have a Books and Books, it's easy to dismiss. Well, just go to booksandbooks.com or just go here and there. But the idea, the heart of that, is that there aren't choices for people out there, right? And the other thing is, the question is, well, there was some stuff thrown around about culture, and also the word consumer was thrown out like 9 million times. And for us to change these problems, we have to change the culture. So what is it going to take for us to change the culture of calling us consumers? What comes to my mind when you say the word consumer is a pig at the trough, just eating with no like sense of when to end and what waste they're laying upon the land, right? So we are citizens of this country, and I'd love for us to be able to look at us as that kind of individual.
Well, Astrid Taylor, I think...
Yes.
I think in your book, the way that you urge us to consider that there can be alternatives is in fact moving in that direction that he was speaking about.
Right. I mean, you know, part of my book is I felt like there was a lot of faith in the idea that the technology was going to make this transformation for us, and it was going to bring about a more participatory culture, and that in a way we're like, okay, just trust the technology, let it run its course, and the things we don't like about the old system are going to be broken up. And I think what we're seeing is how much power the marketplace, the context, the economic context has over the technology and how it evolves. And so I feel like that's the deeper level we need to be talking about and addressing. It's not surprising to me in a world of increasing, you know, sickening inequality that what we're seeing is the internet kind of, you know, amplify the advantage of pre-existing winners and broadening the gulf between the sort of haves and the have-nots on the level of, you know, money and attention. So... you know, I think what I aim to do in my book is just to say, okay, we need to actually challenge the sort of faith in technology as something that can transform our social world. We need to look at the way that it's shaped by these economic forces. And that was sort of my goal with the book. As far as the consumer thing, I just think it's very pervasive in our culture, and it's You know, one of the counter arguments to the book has always been like, well, convenience. You know, Amazon is convenient, and convenience is a consumer value. And I think we need to push back on that as something that, you know, underpins a lot of our choices and our activities.
Right. And Frank Foer, I'll let you get the last word in on that. How about moving us beyond this notion of ourselves as consumers?
Right. We have certain expectations about the stuff that we get. And it's shaped by the world that we live in this marketplace. We expect that we should get everything as cheaply as possibly and as efficiently as possibly. And to some extent, those are tenets of capitalism. But they haven't always been tenets of American political economy. There have been moments in our past, in our not-so-distant past, where we've said, okay, it's not necessarily the most important thing to get things as cheaply as possibly. Sometimes, in order to create a truly healthy marketplace, we're going to have to pay a little bit more as consumers, and maybe it'll take 36 hours as opposed to 24 hours to get what we want. Like, okay, that's choices that we're going to have to accept. We can't do them. What we do individually matters on some level, but if you look at the big mass of the American economy, things will only change if they change in a macro sort of way. If we make collective decisions about how policy affects our marketplace,
and people who make collective decisions are citizens, not consumers.
Exactly.
That's right.
Or take things out of the marketplace. I mean, there are plenty of areas of social life that we don't totally give to the marketplace, like healthcare, ideally, or education. And I feel like culture, you know, should be in that. In that litany as well. So it's, thinking beyond the marketplace is...
Well, we've been talking today whether or not monsters rather live in our laptops, and it was a fascinating tale of digital disruption, not necessarily one of good and evil. And I want to thank our panelists for joining us today. Andrew Albanese, senior writer of Publishers Weekly, Frank Foer, the editor of The New Republic, Astra Taylor, author of The People's Platform, Taking Back Power and Culture in the Digital Age, and Oren Tyker, CEO of the American Booksellers Association. I want to thank the Knight Foundation and the Miami Book Fair. My name is Chris Keneally. Thank you all for joining us.